From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. It is going to be years before we understand just how costly the recent fires in Los Angeles are going to be. But a conservative estimate right now is somewhere in the neighborhood of $250 billion. And that makes this the costliest disaster in U.S. history. And of course, this is what disaster insurance is supposed to be for. Insurance companies set premiums, customers pay those premiums, and if the actuarial work is accurate, everything works out. Disasters happen, and it's true that nobody is ever the same, but people who have been insured are protected from losing everything. And those losses are kept from compiling in ways that send shocks to the broader economy. But the economist Gary Yeo says there's a problem with this model. Historically, the insurance system has worked by relying on experts who study records of past events to estimate how likely it is that a covered event might happen. But thanks to climate change, risks are increasingly difficult to measure, and costs are increasingly catastrophic. And that means a lot of insurers are either setting premiums so high that customers simply can't afford them, or the insurers are declining to write policies at all. And that might turn out to have even wider implications, because mortgage companies won't lend to customers without insurance. And so this may soon impact home buying. And Yeo says the ripple effects could be devastating to the economy. Gary Yeo is the Huffington Foundation Professor of Economics and Environmental Studies at Wesleyan University. He's also the author of more than 175 studies and several books. And he's been a senior member of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Gary Yeo, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's very nice to be here.
Gary, from the very start of your academic career, you were focused on the economic tolls of the damages that humans do to the earth. And that's not all you did, but the intersection of pollution and profit has been the subject of some of your earliest published papers back in the 1970s. It continued to be a theme in your work throughout your career. What was happening in your life, in the world, that drew you to this part of economic thought?
Back in around 1981, Bill Nordhaus phoned me up. He had been a dissertation advisor of mine, and I had written a dissertation on prices versus quantities under uncertainty, now known as cap and trade taxes versus standards, and was essentially a theoretical economist worried about decision-making under uncertainty. But he phoned up and asked me if I wanted to be involved in a National Academy of Sciences study to be entitled Changing Climate. He was on a panel. There were a number of other folks. He thought it would be interesting. Seemed like a good idea at the time, so I said yes and became part of that panel. It wrote about changing climate. Bill created the first version of his aggregated emissions model, driven by economics with 10 sources of uncertainty. The author team of the panel included 5 people who will ultimately win Nobel Prizes, including Bill. And by the time we were done, I was hooked on the low-hanging fruit of this enormous public goods problem under enormous uncertainty with century-long time horizons. At that point in time, Tom Schelling, Bill Nordhaus, and I were on the panel, maybe 2 other economists in the world knew anything about climate change.
I mean, you say this was low-hanging fruit, but you also say, and correctly so, like almost nobody else was thinking about this at that time. And in 1983, you published this paper. You're part of this group. You published this paper on the future carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuels. How did your group see so clearly then, at a time in which the science was still fairly nascent, that this was such an environmental problem and then an economic problem?
This is going to sound silly, but essentially because nobody else had done it or thought about it. The economists in the room had this public goods view or public bads externality view of the problem. A lot of really smart people in the room met many, many times and just sort of made stuff up and bounced it off the walls and see what people thought. Tried to organize our thoughts, what we could tell about damages It was very, very minimal. We had to sort of quantify that, admit that we really didn't know what it was going to be. So, okay, we'll run the model with three different assumptions about what the level of damages would be. And the elasticity, the degree to which you could substitute fossil fuel for non-fossil fuel, the rate of growth of population and labor productivity, and the atmospheric constant for warming and forcing, and the carbon fraction, what fraction of the carbon that's thrown up in the air every year stays in the atmosphere for more than a year. And so we had 10 sources of uncertainty. The ranges were enormous. And we invented spaghetti graphs.
Was the fact that you weren't scared to play in those sandboxes, did that have anything to do with how many different academic sandboxes you had played in as an undergraduate? Because I think I heard you had like four undergraduate paths before you settled on economics.
I did. I hadn't thought about that, but I guess that's true. I knew the vocabulary of a lot of different disciplines. So I couldn't talk the science, but I could understand the words of the atmospheric chemists in the room.
You wrote in a recent piece in The Conversation that you understand that some degree of suffering is inevitable under human-caused global warming. And I'm wondering about when during your career that became really clear in your mind, this realization that this thing you had been looking at, worried about, writing about since the early 1980s, had jumped from the realm of potential harm and entered the realm of inevitable and widespread harm.
That was really an evolution. At the beginning, I was worried about emissions, and the policy choice there is mitigation, abatement, slow the pace of emissions. As I started to get involved in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, impacts became something that I worried a lot about. And there weren't very many economists who would be able to take impacts and express them quantitatively. It didn't take me very long to figure out that not all of these impacts could be measured in dollars and cents. And so we needed a wide range of metrics, or at least more than one, to be able to capture the diversity of the problem. And that led me to thinking about five reasons for concern. And one of them was extreme events, the likelihood of extreme events. And tipping points, actually. They were called singularities in the jargon of physicists, but it was just sort of sudden systematic changes in an environmental or global system or an economic system or a social system that would happen suddenly and from which you couldn't go back. And that all sort of evolved. But I think the first time it ever made sense to me succinctly was when I was vice chair of the National Climate Assessment under President Obama, and John Holdren was his director of Office of Science and Technology Policy and his primary science advisor. And he convinced the president very quickly. And everywhere John went, he gave a talk on climate, he would say, humanity has three choices, abate, adapt, or suffer. And it was just the clear recognition that regardless of how well we did in the first two, we couldn't protect ourselves from everything. So that in all likelihood, sometimes small, sometimes large, recognized people would suffer, sometimes a lot, sometimes not so much, but that was just unavoidable.
So here you've basically been standing on a rooftop. You've put literal dollar signs next to what this is. We know what the cost increasingly is going to be in human suffering and misery. And for decades, you're sort of standing on a rooftop screaming at people to pay attention to this. Does it get frustrating? I mean, over time, do you feel like, man, like I did my best, but they're not paying attention?
Well, it got frustrating, but a lot of us sat down and we talked about exactly that question. And we just decided there were certain people out there that it wasn't worth being resentful about. We couldn't change their minds. It took up a lot of energy. You had to watch what they were doing every day and wasn't at all productive. And so we thought we needed to continue. And those people weren't 50%. They were 20%. So let's just go.
And so, you know, here we are. Humans have already raised the average global temperature by about 3 degrees Fahrenheit. The consequences of that extra energy in our atmosphere and our oceans is a substantially destabilized climate where the risks that were built into the places where we set up societies were once broadly known, but those risks have changed and are going to continue to change. And we can't just easily pack up entire societies, entire nations. And in any case, even if we could, the risks have pretty much risen everywhere else. It's a substantial problem.
It really is. And you've hit the nail on the head with respect to insurance, because your story about how insurance premiums are set is actuarially astute statisticians do the numbers and estimate the likelihood of this happening or that happening or having an accident if you live in Utah instead of live in New York City or upstate New York, a variety of things like that. And then that's what they charge people, and people decide how much coverage they want and how much deductibles they want. And they're willing to self-insure for the low-end damages, but they really want to be protected from the bad things, the really bad things that could happen.
It's like catastrophic coverage.
The catastrophic coverage is blown up in part because the climate is way outside of what we've observed. How many times have you heard this is a 1,000-year flood or this is a biblical storm? This is the worst fires in Southern California, and they get a lot of fires. This is the worst heat wave that Europe has ever suffered. This is the first time that Vladivostok has been over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. How many times do you have to see that to realize that what you observed, even from the recent past, isn't at all indicative of the worst things, the upper tails of distributions of what will happen in the future?
And this is a real challenge for actuarial assessment of risk, because the way we've always done this is through looking at the history of an area like Los Angeles, that, as you say, has always been prone to some wildfires, but you've suggested, and certainly recent evidence affirms, that history is no longer a good guide for likely risks anymore. And that's also being played out right now in these fires in Southern California, which are really unprecedented.
Yeah, about 10 or 15 years ago, insurance companies went to their regulators and successfully started to argue, starting in Connecticut, actually, that they shouldn't be held to setting premiums based on historical data. They should be allowed to project forward 10 years and set premiums on the basis of what those futures might look like. And they discovered in Connecticut that made insurance along the coastline very expensive. And they made the mistake of trying to do it overnight, and it just blew up in their face, and everybody got mad. And they backed off a little bit, but then they realized there was an opportunity, and it has to do with the adaptation option. Okay, we're going to increase your premiums to cover your house. But here's a list of things that you could invest in and do to protect your house and reduce the damages of your property. And if you undertake those, we will reduce your premiums accordingly, not because the likelihood of the storm is going to be any smaller, but that the consequences of that storm are going to be small. And there were people in Connecticut, the rich people on the Gold Coast, who actually earned 11% returns on their adaptation investments, because that's how much their premiums would go down.
But as you could say, we can't do this overnight.
And we can't do it very well now, because the pace of change isn't this gradual, sort of predictable, projectable sea level rise. It is these sudden, enormous things that were unimagined until they happened. They are no longer high consequence, low probability events. They are now higher consequence, unknown probability events. And that means that their likelihood could be 50%. We just don't know.
And so the result is that we have this system that we've relied on to create relatively fair insurance products, and it's really not equipped to handle the risks that we now face. And that's bad enough, but there's an extra wrinkle here that you point out, which is that most people can't borrow money for a home without insurance. And so you've likened this to a contagion, where problems with one part of the economy begin creating problems in other parts.
Right. And that's not my invention. That's the Federal Reserve Board of the United States, following the lead of central banks in Europe that were 4 or 5 years ahead of them, looked at the 2008-2009 financial collapse worldwide. It was born of problems with mortgages and real estate markets. 250 brokers in a room in London who had never seen the market go down put everybody at risk, and it all got bundled and distributed into the banking and financial systems at Merrill Lynch and Chase Bank and places like that. And the bottom fell out of that market. Homes were being foreclosed because people couldn't pay the mortgages, or wouldn't, because the value of their property was now less on the market than the mortgage that they were paying. So they would just walk away from the mortgage. The Fed got word of that and came to realize after some study that big climate events could be the source of that sort of financial ramification across the entire banking system. And what they had in mind was the collapse of the West Arctic ice sheet that could create a yard or two of sea level rise within a decade and a half. And it's not likely, but it was not implausible. And so they started to run, they do stress tests of the banking system every year and give the banks scenarios of bad things that might happen and ask how they would respond. And then they do it again and they learn from it and things like that. They started to make up stress tests that were based on climate, mostly sea level rise. And it was hypothetical. It was not implausible. Nobody could put a likelihood on it, but it was non-zero. And the central banks thought it would be good if we practiced. Well, now, thanks to California, they have something that isn't hypothetical. It's actually happening. And people are going to be walking away from mortgages. The mortgages, the properties are misvalued. They're embedded in the portfolios of banks all across the country. And so the banks have made plans, and now they're going to get the test how well they planned, because they've got a real-life emergency on their hands.
And there's almost no place worse that this could have happened in terms of, you know, the value of properties, because this is an area where properties are valued in the millions of dollars, and that's not equivalent to what most people are paying for mortgages across the country. And so that's a lot of value to overcome.
It is. Some of us would from time to time think, what's it going to take to get enough people's attention that we really take climate risk seriously and really engage in robust policy and behavior change? And the answer was a really big, very costly, very visible event or two or three happening very, very close to TV and movie cameras, and where there would be a lot of coverage, so it wouldn't just be the people in California know this terrible thing is happening. People in Afghanistan know this terrible thing is happening.
Do you think that hypothesis will be borne out?
I'm not projecting it. I'm just saying that this is something we really have to pay attention to. I don't want anybody to think I'm projecting a financial collapse. I'm not. I'm saying that a financial collapse is possible. And if you ask me how likely, I will answer, I don't know.
And here's the real problem. I mean, we have two systems that seem very hard to change, at least rapidly. We have an insurance system where insurers can't write policies in which the premiums, you know, don't cover, you know, insurers can't write a policy if the premium doesn't cover the actual rising risk. And then we've got a mortgage system that can't lend money if a home isn't insured. So where do we go? How do we fix this conundrum?
A thought comes from the Connecticut experience. How can you, and what do you encourage people to do that would make the adjustments less expensive or less dramatic or less impossible? And okay, they're going to rebuild a lot. There's $250 billion is an unbelievable number. It has no credibility. You know it's wrong, but you know it's probably too low by the time you figure out how to put an entire community back together with the infrastructure and the schools and where people have to live, to work, and all of that. But as they rebuild, some places they shouldn't rebuild. Other places they should look at the house the one house on the street that didn't burn down and say, why did that happen? What did those people do that made it protected from what other people suffered, and make it in people's best interest to undertake those investments.
When you think back to those early years, the early 1980s, when you were first becoming introduced to this concept, when you were with only a few other lone wolves talking about it, let alone talking about it in terms of dollars and cents, could you have envisioned the trajectory that we've been on in the 40 years since? Or, you know, was there part of you that said, ah, we're going to identify this problem, and the more serious we take it, the more serious other people will take it, and we'll overcome this?
Not in the 1980s or even in the 1990s, but I think I came to realize it in at the end of the century and going into this century. And it came to me in the context of, if this is a giant public goods problem, then it's a giant benefits and costs problem. And that means you have to have dollars and cents for all of the benefits and all of the costs, the benefits of the policies and the costs of the residuals, and have to worry about discounting and things like that. And any program for between now and 2100 that you propose is a slow moving target. And it was. And from that came, there has to be a better way of thinking about that. And from that came, this is not a cost-benefit problem. This is a risk management problem. And okay, well, you need probabilities for and losses and things for that. Well, society has a lot of those risk management problems for which they don't really have those. Building codes don't guarantee the building won't fall down. They just guarantee, to the best of their ability, that the chance that it falls down is very, 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 very small. We don't set speed limits at 25 miles an hour because a lot of people die at 65 miles an hour. So we're willing to tolerate those sorts of risks. So what if you thought about the climate problem as a tolerable risk problem? So adaptation is, how much do we have to invest to reduce the likelihood of this really, really bad event to a level that's tolerable, that society has shown to be? Take a look at where it changes from, I can live with that, to, I'm really uncomfortable with that, to, I can't tolerate that at all. And that sets a temperature target for which now the problem isn't maximize benefits and costs, the problem is minimize the cost of achieving that level of tolerable risk. Secondly, recognize that you're going to have to make mid-course corrections. Every 20 or 30 years, you have to look at how things are going, and you're doing too much or you're doing too little. You make adjustments as you move along. And the body politic has to realize that if you make an adjustment in 2050, that doesn't mean you were lying in 2025.
Tolerable risk problems, really belief of risk problems, right? Like you have to account for what people believe the risk actually is. And then, you know, that becomes a climate communication problem as well.
Yes, and it becomes a perception problem to the receivers of the communication. There's a theory that we came up with that the level of adaptive capacity for a community has a number of underlying determinants, whether there are options to adapt, whether there are resources, whether or not there's leadership, people, whether or not people can separate the signal of climate change from the noise of the weather, that sort of thing. But out of the health literature has come a conclusion that the most important determinant of responding to a health issue and or responding to a climate issue is public trust. Public trust in the science and public trust in the communicators of the science. And that implies to me a lack of disinformation and misinformation deliberately distributed by people for whom the myopic consequences of actions to protect people's lives or actions to protect people's property from climate change are negative.
That's a big load to carry right now. That's Gary Yeo. He's the Huffington Foundation Professor of Economics and Environmental Studies at Wesleyan University. He's also the author of more than 175 studies and several books, and he's been a senior member of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Gary Yeo, thank you.
Thank you very much, Matthew. I've had a very good time and appreciate your finding me.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us, then you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. And from listeners like you, you can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LeBlanc. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.